You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on September 15th, 2012, here on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. Also ahead today on the program, in the wake of those topless photos of the Duchess of Cambridge, what's the value of an image when it appears on the printed page versus online? Our culture editor Robert Bound has a view or two.
Describing blurred and pixelated long-lens topless shots of Prince William's wife as a beautiful series is a nice way of trying to get away with it.
And from Sydney via the World Newspaper Association conference in Kiev, we talk about the state of Aussie newspapers with the man at the helm of the publishing giant Fairfax.
I love newspapers, but it's not for us to tell people how they should or they shouldn't access our journalism. And so we'll just structure the company on the basis of what, you know, a 21st century media company should be.
All that and a considerable bit more today on The Stack here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 3 of The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly flip through the best glossy magazines, obscure journals from the Pacific Northwest of the United States, and solid weekend newspaper supplements. I'm Tyler Brulé. Earlier this week, I was in Australia, where there was considerable discussion about the future of the country's most respected newspapers and also the recent takeover of ACP, Australian Consolidated Press, by heaven forbid, Germans. With considerable chat about what publishers Bauer might do to the likes of Australia's Women's Weekly and Bell, it sounded like the arrival of fresh cash from the Federal Republic was the worst thing in the world. As one of the world's most hungry magazine markets, Australian journalists, newsstand operators, and most importantly, readers, should be thrilled that a keen and knowledgeable media group is now in charge. We'll have more on Australian print media in a moment, but first, the guests around the table. I want to introduce our very, very dear friend, chef and author Allegra McEvity. Loves all things functional and tactile, tasty and high quality, which is why she's seated here with a few titles to tuck into this morning. Her most recent book, Bought, Borrowed and Stolen, Recipes and Knives from a Traveling Chef, is a perfect example of everything print media should be doing, of course, and it's why she's a firm favorite around here. Welcome.
Hello, Tyler.
How have you been?
I've been good. I've been missing
you. We still have to have that Japanese lunch that we talked about around Christmas time.
Yeah, I think we need maybe get David Chang to cook it for us.
Okay, I like that idea. We'll be talking more about future projects in a moment. Also across the way today, we have Peter York, author, broadcaster, journalist, commentator, former resident of Marylebone, and now, can we still say that you're a pioneer in Pimlico?
I am a pioneer in Pimlico, and I need more to help me.
I wanted to ask you, going back to Peter, have you actually found a newsstand that you like and love in Pimlico yet?
No. It lacks retailing. Retailers, come to Pimlico. It's lovely. There are opportunities in Pimlico for retailers.
But maybe that's a good thing. I mean, maybe, you know.
And restaurateurs.
Okay, all right.
Well, I don't want to have to go to Belgravia, you know.
You can get a good bra in Pimlico, actually.
A good bra?
A very good bra.
Really?
Found in Pimlico, yes, and on Pimlico Green.
Do you want to share more about that?
Pimlico Green. Pimlico Green, that isn't Pimlico.
Really?
No, Pimlico Green is the Pimlico Road. That's just on the way to Pimlico. It isn't real Pimlico.
Right, I can
it's
see
really
that.
A branch of Chelsea.
Yes, I can see I'm going to get absolutely out Pimlico here.
You're going to get totally outgunned on that front. Listen, I thought before we crack a few spines, we might want to reflect on the media storm that's been kicked up over the last 24 hours in the UK, indeed around the world, with the publication of topless photos of the Duchess of Cambridge in the French weekly Closer. Last night, Italian titled Chi announced they'd also be running the photos in a massive 24-page portfolio, and no doubt others will follow. We asked our culture editor Robert Bound to just consider the impact of the images on the printed page rather than those just on a backlit screen. Does it matter more that ink was committed to paper rather than megabytes simply uploaded? And does paper leave a more lingering trail?
Kate's got a beautiful series, according to Laurence Piot, the editor of Closer in Paris, and she'd know. It seems a languidly Gallic way to attempt to describe away a media furore with the suggestion of the aesthetic, the hint that a rare work of art and thing of beauty has been rescued and is now being displayed to an appreciative public for the first time. Describing blurred and pixelated long-lens topless shots of Prince William's wife as a beautiful series is a nice way of trying to get away with it. Because in the UK, we wouldn't say that. In the UK, especially the mid or post-Leveson UK, or whatever part of the media carve-up we're currently living through, our editors crow about public interest and ask and complain with a proper hurt expression about how certain people of entitlement in the establishment want to have the shirts off their poor broken backs, how they want to have their worthwhile investigative public-serving personages sold to the bloody cleaners. I can't imagine the British editors of Heat or Star or Closer telling a blood-scenting interrogator that Kate, frankly, has a cracking set, and aren't we all lucky to have had a look at them, by goodness. Aside from a question for another time, namely, what the hell's happened to the normally staid world of French publishing? First Madame Hollande's holiday snaps were enough to make President Normal into President Fulecon, and now a proper English duchess, the next in line to become the Princess of Hearts, snapped, shockingly, bikini-free in Provence. Just when we thought low rent and red top were the preserves of us chaps over the Channel. And then there's the question of the medium. Print versus digital isn't just a debate to be had over quality titles and whether carefully produced magazines should cave in to the supposed iPad revolution. Print versus digital is more interestingly disseminated when the crowd in the media coliseum are the proles and the argument is about relevance and timeliness and sustained effect. Prince Harry's dick was broken by TMZ, the website that broke Michael Jackson's death and has become the touchstone for celeb-oriented breaking news. But the topless shots of Kate were published on good old paper where, and here's the rub, there's still more editing done and stories are passed through many more hands than by publishing online. There's still the consideration of the commissioning editor's hand, the photo editor's expert eye, the wonderment of the sub-editors bathing the shots in some pithy, punning copy, and the production manager smirking, or maybe not, as the page wends its way to the printers. And the printers themselves, smirking and chuckling, or wondering why they're seeing these pictures of someone else's wife. Crap, isn't it, when you break it down like that? But it also shows that paper's where the power is. There's an extra level of importance, and in this case offence, when a story, or a non-one, is committed to paper. It attains a sense of history quicker, of having happened at all. It's a sad test case for a changing media landscape that shows that paper won't ever be first again, but its pull and potency still rule. Yet Closer sure has a mean way with a beautiful series. For Monocle, I'm Robert Bound.
And that was indeed our culture editor. Peter, I wanted to ask you... Your take on this, of course, we saw many weeks ago images of Prince Harry that were uploaded and they made their way onto websites all over the world. And of course, many said, you know, here is a willing gentleman frolicking around in a rather large jacuzzi in Las Vegas and sort of doesn't matter. But here we have these images published by a rather, a considerable French newsweekly or certainly celebrity newsweekly of scale, you know, approaching almost 500,000 copies a week. You know, does it matter? Is there something in the fact that you know, ink was indeed, splashed across paper that makes this a different story?
Yes. It's real when it's ink, even though we've been trained to not to think that. We do think that. I think that. I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker. So it is important. And it's also attributable when it's ink. And it's accountable in a quite different way. And that's why you can sue it more readily.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Because it's on paper, does it also mean that it's also backed by paper and you can go
yes.
after euros or pounds or dollars
yes.
as well?
Because one of the things about things online is that they're so elusive. One of the things about investigations online is that they're so weedy. You can see that there is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
Allegra, what do you make of this? Aside from, you know, whether it is right or wrong, in this era, but, you know, going back to if this was something which just went up on someone's blog, or even if it was on something of a reputable news site, Do you think it has a different level of impact that suddenly at every train station, at every airport, at every petit kiosk across France, suddenly you can see this?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it does is it makes it unmissable. Like, for all the fact that, you know, I'm not particularly interested in Prince Harry's bits, I actually didn't see them. I would have seen them if they'd been on the front of every magazine. But, you know, I missed them completely, which is no bad thing. Whereas I think that if, you know, if they are literally kind of on the cover of, you know, every magazine, and then you will, you couldn't avoid it, which I think is a bit sad for her. I also think, you know, to be honest, print costs money, and you know, why waste good money on something such as, you know, so ridiculous as this?
But maybe that's just the other side. It's that that point about that there is cash there, and that there is this sort of, you know, commitment. I mean, there's almost two sides to it as well, Peter, isn't it? Because, you know, the fact that you actually actively go and purchase, I think, also adds a different level of debate. As you were saying, you didn't go just to go and sort of search out the images of Harry online. It passed you by. You had every opportunity to do it. But there's almost a different level of currency, isn't there, Peter? Because also, I have to go, I don't know how much closer cost in France. Is it one, you know, €1.90? Is it €1? Who knows?
And is it a sort of licensed job from a Richard Desmond publication? Who exactly owns Closer?
I don't want to go into the financials and the organizational chart. Now, I know that the French edition that we're talking about is owned by Mondadori from Italy, which, of course, is a considerable publisher of scale, both in magazines and books. Closer in the UK is owned by Bauer, which is the German media company, which was a spin-off out of, because Bauer came in from Germany, and as I was saying in the intro, you know, they've just snatched up things in Australia. They bought up at least large chunks of EMAP.
I don't read Closer, but is it sort of one above, sorry to surprise you there.
maybe we should write out and get some copies while we're on air.
Who is the readership?
It's certainly not you, and it's obviously not me. And Peter, it sounds like you can't find it in Pimlico either, can you?
I've not really been looking.
No.
Look closer.
Well, it's because, you know, all that stuff, that whole raft of celebrity magazines feels very 90s now. I don't buy them anymore.
There's nothing 90s about Tits and Bits. They will never go out of fashion.
No, they'll never go out of fashion, but that sort of particular package of celebrity stuff has gone out of fashion because they were in oversupply.
But do you think that Tits and Bits have...
You said it.
You said it first. I can't believe I'm saying it at 10:16 in the morning in London. Do you think that that those things also, they have more of a place online? But, you know, we say that, and yet, of course, then we're having this discussion about the Duchess of Cambridge's bits, you know, caught on a long lens in France. But because, you know, many would sort of, you know, talk about the more salacious end of the industry, that, you know, porn, etc., sort of, you know, clearly has moved online and perhaps has a place there. But I'm wondering...
In the most innocent sense, I mean, we've all grown up with Page Three in this country. Mm. You know, I mean, that's, you know, that's been there. It's been a part of my childhood. I'm a very happy part of my childhood, I'd like to say.
Carry on world, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. But it's so innocent, you know. And in a way, there's something a little bit more, obviously intrusive, but I think a little bit more sinister about how these pictures of the poor Duchess of Cambridge have been achieved.
Well, it's interesting because if you listen to the editor of Key in Italy, who is also part of the Mondadori group, so this is the closer cousin, Alfonso Signorini, he says the fact that these are the future rulers of England makes the article more interesting and topical. And this is what he's saying. It's like a quote from the BBC this morning. Doesn't make it more interesting and topical, do you think? Just because these are, you know, and he's trying to paint this picture that, you know, this is a loving couple and, you know, they're on holiday and look how modern they are.
Well, I don't know. The downside of the upside, because the upside was that William and Kate have been hugely publicized as the future of the royal family. And that's been a conscious decision. She is a very modern, globally acceptable person. People are interested in, very, very interested in her. She's the Vanity Fair cover girl. Mm. And if you do that, there's a danger attached to it. You know, and it's a fine set of judgments to be made. I think They'll be withdrawing a bit now.
I think, perhaps it's this phrase that they always come back to in these kind of issues that the journalists and the editors always throw out, which is, it's in the public interest. How can it be in the public interest to know, you know, who's sleeping with who, you know, in terms of celebrity footballers or, you know, or Harry's, you know, running around in a hot tub with a goodness knows what on or off. and, you know, but they always say it's, you know, that's the thing they fall back on. And I just say, well, where is the line on that? I mean, why is it in the public interest to see, you know, our future Queen's knockers?
Well, it's publicly interesting, but actually it's very, people say, oh, there'll be confusion now. Oh, there'll be repression. Actually, post-Leveson, actually, it's very easy to define. Fantastically easy to define the difference between intrusion and, you know, important investigative journalism. And they're deliberately, or, you know, the red tops are deliberately trying to confuse the thing. It's not confusing. You know, you could define it on, you know, in half a paragraph.
Just before we go on this, because I don't want to spend too much time on any royal topics on this little radio network of ours. But before we go, are you slightly surprised? I'll throw this out to both of you, that there is this sense of outrage on the part of the red tops, the tabloids in this country, just given, you know everything else that, you know, that we've seen certainly over the last year with the inquiry, etc., that's going on. And here, you know, if you look at all the papers this morning, it's like the worst thing that could have possibly happened.
Well, obviously, it's because it's done by frogs and dagos. So obviously it's worse by definition, and they are more intrusive.
I think that's frogs and wops, not dagos.
Frogs and wops. Or frogs and wops. Frogs and wops are doing this. They have no self-control. And that, what is the link to Berlusconi here? There's apparently in the Italian magazine, there is a Berlusconi.
Mondadori, in fact, is part owned by one of Berlusconi's media groups. So, and who own both the French edition of the licensed version and also then Key Magazine Italy.
But in fact, all the red tops are absolutely churning with fury that they can't do it.
I'm with Peter on that one. Yeah, I think they're just cross that they can't quite. Yes. They can't knit this on themselves.
Right. Well, we'll have more, or potentially more, frogs and wops, tits and bits, right here on the Stack, the appropriately named Stack, in fact, on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
J. Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Malchin says,
we're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J. Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy, and so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. You know, like the details are traditional, but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J. Crew.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
And you're back with a Stack here on Monocle 24, 1923 in Sydney, 1023 here in London, 623 in the morning. Bom dia, if you're listening in Sao Paulo. I am joined by Peter York and Allegra McEvity. Peter's stack looks bigger than yours. Well, not really, but you know what I'm saying, Allegra.
It's all right. Absurd.
When we sort of thought about this, we never thought this was rather sort of, you know, so fraught with innuendo. But anyway, you're Peter, you're pawing a copy of August magazine. This is a title I picked up in Singapore last week. It's published, this is interesting, it's published by Berta magazine. They already have a men's edition, and then they've just, this is the launch edition of their women's title. And I was actually just surprised, because I went immediately to the master to see who publishes it. And what's curious is, you know, you've got all this outrage about, you know, Bauer potentially sort of, or Bauer has bought ACP in Australia. And so I was actually really interested to see that the Germans are in there quite thick in Southeast Asia. You're flipping through it. You're on handbags. I'm seeing you go past lots of nice black and white imagery. What do you make of August? Is it August or August?
I don't know. I think it's quite boring in every way. But what is fascinating is that all the models, the cover person...
That would be Kylie Minogue,
the cover person. Is Kylie... in a reflective and rather French-influenced shot, not bubbly Kylie. She's reflective Euro Kylie, which is one of her dressing doll things. But actually, of course, it's Singaporean Chinese, and the entire crew of it, because there are pictures of the crew of it, are, but all the models and everything else is very Caucasian. And I can't see how it hangs together. I don't see what it's for and about.
Mm. Did you manage to get into it yet? Pass it across.
August. No, I just... it's interesting you said that it looks so European, because from where upside down, the cover looks like a cross between the Barbra Streisand photo and Edie Sedgwick. So not at all European, much more American.
But I think it was very astute of you to pick up on that. It looks rather Gallic, Peter, because, in fact, she is promoting her film that that had its premiere in Cannes, and it is a bit of a Frenchy film as well. Continuing our frogs theme on this program today.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, you're never really going to get me with the Paris catwalk and the handbags. I'm afraid that's it's more your department, Tyler, than mine.
Well, it's not mine. maybe in a former life, Allegra. You've got a couple of things earmarked, and we're in a bit of a foodie world. Just on your side of the table, Allegra, what did you want to start with? What do you have over there?
Well, I think food in magazines is in publications is actually getting to a very interesting place. I think it got completely stuck for a while there, kind of in the 1990s. That all those very glossy, very sort of soft focus napkin ring photography, and it got to a stage where, you know, any decent chef was wanted to get a Bic buyer and stick it in their throat if they saw another one of those. But now there's this new push of magazines and journals and quarterlies. Gather, I like.
Yeah, so this is one we've wanted to have it on the program almost since launch. So you've got Gather. Take us through the magazine, and how does that contrast to all of the soft focus napkin rings and that sort of world of photography that, you know, might have been part championed by Vogue Entertaining. It might have been Martha Stewart. There's various people who try to lay claim to it. But what's Gather all about?
Well, it's very international, but it not in a kind of forced way. It just feels very real. They've got lovely articles. There was a very nice one I can't quite find right now on a chamomile eel flottante, which is just a very nice kind of, you know.
Can we send some of those in, please?
Please, will you two stop it now? Or there's, you know, I mean, it's basically, it's food that I would like to cook, and you don't often see a lot of that. Steak caponata and burrata. Lovely. Even rolls nicely off the tongue. Do you like the look of that?
No.
I didn't think you would. I knew you wouldn't.
Messy.
Messy food. Food is messy. Cooking is messy. At least when I do it, it is.
I like industrial food.
It's a bit like
it's
sex.
All neat and packaged.
Yeah, exactly. And a bit like sex, I just said. But, you know, if it's not messy, you're not doing it right, in my opinion.
I need to go back to that, Peter. Does that mean that you love perhaps an airline tray sat in front of you?
God, I love an airline tray, yes.
Absolutely adore.
And I think it's a miracle how they make airline food. It's so tasty and so tiny and so packaged up. I love it.
Like, you might have something to say about that.
It's making me squirm in my seat. How can you possibly say it's tasty? It tastes like it's been produced at, you know, in a factory far, far away, thousands of feet below where you're actually eating it. And there's nothing fresh about it. Nothing. Peter, you are.
Yeah, it's fine by me.
Oh, but look, what about this one here? This is a really nice looking salad. That is raw shaved asparagus. Mmm, yummy, with a poached egg.
It's all right. It's all right.
What do you feel about salt? There's a very interesting article about salt in here.
I once had this very interesting conversation with Adrian Gill, who is exercised about these things. And I said all salt was salty. And he said that funny, crunchy, wunchy, salty salt was more salty than Saxa. Well, I don't believe it.
I'm afraid that we all, or anyone who has a palate, thinks that there is salt and then there is salt.
Well, that's what I've been told. It may be that industrial salt has got additives, which may slightly change the flavour, but otherwise, the chemical action and all that stuff, it's about the decorative prettiness of the crystalline thing that gets you lot.
No, not at all.
It works exactly the same way.
I'm not a ponce about salt, but there just is a difference in flavour. Like, for example, that very classic dish you can do with turbot baked in salt, or any fish.
Yeah,
which is just delicious. I have done that with dishwasher salt, and it tastes great. So it's not like, you know, you
Was that in a moment a small emergency?
Well, no, it was just kind of...
Or drunkenness.
Just wanting to see, you know, just try. But then on the other hand, one of the greatest dishes I ever had was at Per Se, Thomas Keller's New York restaurant, which was foie gras with a tasting of 9 different salts. You know, you had the black volcanic salt, the Himalayan pink salt. It was just such fun. For a salt junkie like me, it was heaven.
Nightmare for you, Peter. So if we dipped into your Pimlico pantry, Peter, we wouldn't find any red Murray River salt.
No. None of those things. Absolutely none of them.
Saxa.
Nothing sort of rakes.
A giant red container of Saxa. That's what I've got.
I want you to, if you can find somewhere, we brought down a copy of Australian Gourmet Traveller.
You've got it.
I love those words all together.
Australia, Gourmet and Traveller.
Yeah.
Is it an odd collision?
Wonderful collision. I've been thinking recently about Earl's Court and the fact that the Australians have gone.
Who lives in Earl's Court now?
Well, Thai ladyboys. This is what my my local friend tells me.
Right.
A lot of Thai ladyboys in the Earl's Court supermarkets.
Working on checkout.
Well, who is to know?
We'll have to go and investigate that this afternoon if we have nothing to do. I just wanted to contrast, you know, Gather magazine is very much a, you know, it feels, and maybe it's sort of speaking to what you talked about earlier, it's a little bit more authentic and real in terms of its approach to photography. Beautifully produced, though. I mean, this is not something which is, you know, slapped together either. But it does, Gather represents, you know, a very different generation of food publishing in periodical form. And, you know, Aussie Gourmet Traveller is part of another world in a way.
Exactly. And I brought along Food and Travel, which I put in the same bracket as this, which I think is a good magazine.
I mean, I like Australian Gourmet Traveller, and it's one of those ones which I set aside, and it actually goes in my tote bag, and I take it home. And there's a side of me which is maybe not unlike, you know, Peter when it comes to salt. I love all of these new beautiful journals as well, and it's great to see, you know, new titles coming out, but there's also been something quite reassuring about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are, I mean, yeah, I think the difference is that Gourmet Traveller is for, you know, wonderful people like you, but I mean, I am a chef, and I spend my lifetime, you know, fighting against these soft focus napkin rings that clearly do my head in. And so for me, magazines like that, and have you seen, I wanted to bring along, because most of these are New York or American based, Lucky Peach as well, is one to mention. But have you seen Fire and Knives?
Yeah.
Now, do you love that?
I do like that.
Because I mean, what I like. But
I mean, I'm never going to cook anything out of it. I like the fact that it reminds me of, what were those? Were they Ladybird books? Those little Ladybird books that you had as a child. I just love the format of it. There's something which is very, very familiar and slightly childlike.
It's lovely, and it's what happens. I mean, when you take out the recipes, when you take out the restaurant reviews, you take out the wine, you take out the celebrity chefs, and it's what's left of a food magazine once all of that's gone, which is, you know, for a chef or a cook, you know, or someone in the industry, is what's so refreshing about it, because it's all of those things that, you know, that do your head in. You don't want, you know, I'd really, you know, we don't want to see Jamie Oliver endlessly.
No, we don't.
I mean, we love him, but we don't want to see him endlessly.
Peter, Australian Gourmet Traveller, they've got crab rolls with potato chips on the front cover.
Crab rolls weirdly suits you, Peter.
It does look very hotel, doesn't it? Whole thing looks hotel.
They might even serve that up in the front of an aircraft.
I think I'd probably like that. I like the way that looks. It does look quite aircrafty, hotel-y, and slightly industrial.
Okay,
it's good.
Okay, how's this for a segue? We're going to jump from food magazines. You've got management today sitting in front of you.
I've got management, but I just gathered up what was sitting around. So I've got management today, and I've got the John D. Wood Through the Door magazine. These are my magazines, of course. Your magazines from Bleak.
Okay, I stop on Beaufort. Now, Beaufort magazine. Now, this was picked
what
up.
Is it?
That one right there. To me, this is one of the most beautiful sailing magazines, and it's from Finland. One of our colleagues picked it up, and they were doing some shows up in Helsinki. And you know, and I find that actually the whole world of all of it. I love a boat magazine. I own a very small boat, but boat magazines are kind of like, you know, there's that sort of gourmet traveler world where it's just, you know, it's a stapled glossy, and it sort of tells you the various boats you can buy. And then of course, you know, there are the ones with the big massive gin palaces in them as well. But I like this because it's big format, and it's, you know, I love the reference to the Beaufort scale in the title, and of course you can hear it's printed on very lovely, it's on lovely paper, isn't it?
Yeah, you can hear that.
It's on lovely paper. It looks good. I'm utterly uninterested in its contents except, you know, Red Sails and the Sunset. I like that.
How much is it? I mean, it looks expensive.
Let's see. Can you find a price on there? We're looking. All we know is it's number... They've announced very clearly it's number 1, 2012. And, no, I can't seem to find a price.
Because it's not big. It's not an enormous
magazine. Can you do Finnish?
We have one person on staff. I, of course, have Estonian roots. And Estonian and Finnish are a million miles apart.
Yes.
But I'm not going to try to pronounce too many things out of there. Peter, you've stopped. We're going back to Australia for a moment because you've stopped on the Smith Journal right
there. I don't know what it is.
Well, the Smith Journal is, I would call it I'm not sure if it's the slightly older brother or it's the cousin, the male cousin to Frankie Magazine. Now, Frankie Magazine is a very successful, independent, non-glossy women's magazine in Australia, and this is the male offshoot of Frankie.
Well, you may say this, but I can't get that. You may, when you're looking at a new magazine, if you don't have an inside track to it. Mm. You want to know what it's about, and you want to declare itself quite soon, and it's not at all obvious. Although I like this picture of somebody's desk. I always like pictures of desks. So that suggests to me that it may be for people who have a design education.
Mm.
But otherwise, and in fact, the quality of the paper and all that say that too, but I can't see what it's about. Whereas I very much like The Rake, which obviously is sort of like Fantastic Man. I've never heard of it before, but it's got all the things you might expect. Of course, it's got Brian Ferry on the cover.
Well, we're going to be talking about The Rake a little bit more, but staying with a bit of an Australian theme, we're going to hear from Greg Highwood in a moment, CEO of Fairfax Media. Now, Fairfax Media controls two of the most important newspaper titles in Australia, the Melbourne Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. But while the total readership on both papers is higher than ever, Fairfax is in dire straits. Earlier this year, the company posted its lowest ever share price and announced it would shed 1,900 jobs over the next 3 years. So, how does the company plan to rebound? Monocle's Adrian Craddock spoke recently to Fairfax's CEO, Greg Highwood, to find out more.
I've never been more optimistic. What I've been saying to investors post our results is that we now have a business model which is within reach of a very profitable, digital-first, supplemented by print product across our metro businesses. That's the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. This is something that the market has been extremely concerned about. With declining print revenue, what is the future for these major mastheads, and we believe that we've been so effective at building a market dominant position with our digital audience. We're the number one and number three news media sites in Australia, that we're within reach of a fully profitable digital only model, and we can basically continue to print the newspapers for as long as that's profitable. Now, we don't know how long that will be, but we are on a journey of transformation for these major mastheads, and we're very confident that we'll get there.
You seem quite sure in your tone that the paper will end up folding. Is that the case, or am I misinterpreting that?
I'm not sure that the paper will fold per se. What I'm saying is that we have to structure our business on the basis of the fact that 75% of our audience access our journalism through those mastheads in digital means. And if there is a role for the newspaper, and it is a profitable role for the newspaper, we will continue to produce it. But we're making all the decisions in the company around the basis of managing for any eventuality. Now, personally, you know, I'm a journalist. I wrote for 17 years. I edited papers for another 10. You know, I love newspapers, but it's not for us to tell people how they should or they shouldn't access our journalism. And so we'll just structure the company on the basis of what, you know, a 21st century media company should be, not against the legacy of the 20th century. And I think that's the point I'm really trying to make.
You keep on referring to the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age as mastheads rather than newspapers. Is that deliberate?
It's absolutely deliberate, because the newspaper component of our masthead is one access point. People can access it through online. People can access it through tablet. We're downloaded onto a third of all the iPads in Australia. You can access it through smartphone and IPTV. So it's just a recognition that while a paper is an important and traditional component of accessing the content, it's not the only way.
So how has Fairfax got itself into this position? Do you think they've done things wrong to get themselves in? You know, it's the lowest the share price has ever been.
Yeah. Look, actually, what we've done is we've done the right things. What we did is we put our content, our journalism, up online in 1995, and we now have the largest news audience in the country. It's because we've expanded and put ourselves in a dominant position online that we are now a media company under those mastheads that is within reach of a fully profitable digital model. Now, this is something that many media companies would love to be in. It's a position that they want to be in. So what I'm saying is that while every media company over the last 20 years has made good decisions and bad decisions, and people might say to us that, you know, Fairfax probably should have captured leadership positions in online classifieds. We're very, very strong in real estate, by the way. The thing that we did do well and have done better than most traditional media companies is capture dominant online media leadership. Having got the audience, we can now translate into a digital-only model if that's the way we want to go.
So the readership's still there. It's just a case of harnessing it in a good business model.
You know, we reach 7 million Australians, and that's nearly 40% of the Australian population. So it's not an issue of audience. Our audience has never been larger. Our audience has never been more engaged. But of course, you know, the pressure is on in an intensely competitive media environment to make sure that you're doing two things. You're doing things that generally readers want, but also, and this is the art in what we do, in delivering content, delivering journalism around things that people don't know that they need. The sort of things that interest them, keep them coming back. And so our focus, we know who our audience is, we know generally their needs, but the art is in making sure that we exceed their expectations.
It seems like Fairfax is really leading with the digital now, and the newspaper kind of comes on the back of that. Just personally, would you be bothered if either The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald, if their print sides were gotten rid of and it just became a digital media brand for those two mastheads?
Look, I frankly believe that the newspaper will be around for a long time. Our job as managers of Fairfax is to deliver what the customer wants. And our responsibility is to do that profitably, because we're a publicly listed company with investors who've invested their money on the basis that they want a return. Now, we're going to judge our decisions on the basis of reality, absolutely rational decisions around the future. Many industries in history have been through big transitions, and what you have to do if you want to go through a transition is to make all the decisions that are required. And frankly, we're already in a mix of print and digital. That mix is going to change over time, and if one day in the future it's all digital, so be it. But the reason that that's the case is because that's what the audience wants. That's what the customer wants. That's what we should be delivering.
And that was Greg Highwood, CEO of Fairfax Media, talking to our Adrian Craddock at the World Newspaper Association Conference in Kiev. Peter, I just wanted to ask you before we go away to break. He talks about our audience has never been larger, but then at the same time, their share price has never been lower. What's the problem there?
God, I thought that was boring. I mean, what a boring... I mean, you get an Australian journalist and then you... Presumably, they sent him to INSEAD and got him an MBA, and now he talks this nonsense talk. And then they said, we've got a lot of real estate. You want to hit the floor. And we are in a difficult situation where people's preoccupations with the technology and with platforms takes their eye off the other ball. There are people to fix these things, you know.
I found a bit of a classic and a bit of a clangor in there. It's not for us to tell people how to consume their media.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Our way is best. You know, that's what you should be doing. That's what you get from business school.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, in all seriousness, I mean, if you are sitting around, if I'm an investor in Fairfax and I've sent you off to INSEAD or wherever you've gone and done your fancy degree, wouldn't I expect when you come round for the quarterly review that you are telling me how people should be consuming, not that they just sort of race out to a Westfield mall and try to figure it out for themselves?
Well, I got this sort of a long, languorous feeling out of his funny voice.
Oh, you call it funny. I found it really hard. It was like swimming in treacle by the end. I was getting utterly lost. I'm drowning in there.
We are going to come back in a moment with more of The Stack right after this.
The designers at J.Crew are constantly experimenting with new styles, but it's their staples that they're most proud of. As head menswear designer Frank Mouchens explains, J.Crew's unique approach to tailored clothing led to the now iconic Ludlow suit, recognized for its superior construction and smart bespoke details.
I love it when people start to recognize garments by the way they are cut. It gives it its own personality, and I think that's what we're looking for. And for instance, the low jacket has a specific narrow lapel. It's narrow, but not too narrow. It has a really nice soft shoulder. It has a shoulder pad in it, but just ever so subtly. And I think the low jacket is so great. I think there's about 200 steps it takes to make a low jacket. People maybe sometimes don't realize what it takes to come to this kind of product.
J.Crew.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
And welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24. It's 17:46 in Singapore. Did you know that, Peter? It's 10:46 here in London. That's my segue to the Rake magazine, which you're reading. I want you to describe the Rake. I picked this up as I was going through Changi. It's a magazine I like very much. I don't see it enough in London. That's the sound of thick, glossy paper being flicked.
I love it. It's a magazine for men devoted to clothes, for men who like to be seriously overdressed, and there are some fantastic pictures done in, I think, done in France, done in Paris, of people who are so overdressed, have so many excessive bone buttons on their jackets, they're completely hilarious. This is sort of, look at this, and bits of leather. They're very, in a way, they're hyper and they're smart, and then another way, they're completely naff. I love it.
And from a quality point of view, because we still have enough men's magazines on the newsstand in this country, a little bit earlier, you vaguely referred to it as being like Fantastic Men. But this is... Fantastic Men is much more fashion, isn't it? This is, you know, this is sort of a world of bespoke, and people get, you know, very excited about shoes that probably take 9 years to be made in a very small atelier in some sort of alley off the back of Saint Honoré somewhere, no?
Yes. I mean, I do like it, and it's devoted to some things that I count important in life. My most loved book is Scottish Estate Tweeds. You can flick over it at night and you go to sleep happy. But, and it is, of course, completely absurd. And that here are people all over the world devoted to a disease that is primarily the English disease, which is, which no ordinary English people wear this stuff, of course. It's people like, and the it's a bit like the sartorialist too, because there are observational things of people wearing nice things in places across the world. I like it. It's a bad sign.
Just from a physical production point of view, because I was talking about your book a little bit earlier on, Allegra, and I said, you know, one of the great things when that volume first landed on our desk was just clearly the care and the care that you as a chef and, you know, a publisher now put into it. So I just want, you know, your reflection on that, because to me that's just, you know, it's very glossy, but it's incredibly tactile. And does that matter to you?
Absolutely. Totally. I mean, you know, I was looking at it first of all upside down and then actually needed to hold it and needed to touch it. So I had to take it away from Peter. I think the photographs are beautiful. I mean, they are also hilarious because they are so over the top. I mean, did you clock the one of the editor? I mean, the editor's byline photo could actually be a full frontal, you know, a cover. Mm. It's extraordinary. You know, so there's a huge amount of arrogance going into this. But, you know, I think that it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
I mean, what's interesting about it, and you know, I'm not sure if it's part of the subtext, but it does transport you somewhere else. And do you, to both of you, and Eglifer, do you think there's enough fantasy today? Because what's curious is that I don't get a. I mean, there's some fantasy in Gourmet Traveler because, you know, maybe it's a hyper stylized world, and, you know, will you or won't you go to those lovely hotels in Amalfi? We probably will. And then you have, of course, on the other side, you know, these new food titles, which are a little bit more gritty and rooted in reality.
Yes, and that's much more my kind of you know, that's more what I'm interested in reading. You know, I don't want to read Gourmet Traveller, really. I like reading and seeing what's going on in the world, but essentially when I'm reading about food, I want to read something that is learning for me and is real and isn't just mass-produced for you know, the audience out there. But what I like about The Rake is that even though, I mean, generally men's magazines like that irritate me, the GQs and the other, I just think, oh, you know, it's so aspirational, so obviously aspirational, it's just irritating. That, you know, I quite like to go to Monte Carlo, wear that, you know, £100,000 watch, walk that greyhound, you know, along the front there, and actually and own that yacht.
Peter, you've stopped on you seem to be fantasizing about a Jaeger-LeCoultre watch, and I'm not sure if, and of course, that's advertising that you're looking at, which is always fine as well. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here today. But do you find there's enough fantasy in the world of whether it's sort of men's and style publishing? You know, are we taken to enough places? Are we able to, you know, venture off the page enough? Do you think?
I think most people feel fantasied out because there's been so much access to all kinds of fantasies. But I do think that as times get tough, you want a particular kind of fantasy, and I think that, you know, which is of disciplined consumption. Disciplined consumption with, you know, a lot of heart in it rather than slack stuff.
You like constraints, don't you, Peter?
I like constraints, and I think slacker is a mode for rich people who are getting slack. And this is a mode or a fantasy following for poor people. You know, this is a real poor people's magazine, really, even though it's extremely expensive.
Yeah, that you also have to fly to Changi Airport to get it most of the time as well.
But But these sorts of ideas, are things that are followed by quite poor people who are obsessive.
I think you're going to have to reevaluate what you think is poor to be slightly.
No. Of course you don't. You can't have it, but you can have a go at it.
Well, Allegra mentioned GQ a little bit earlier, and now you want to rifle to the bottom of your pile.
Yeah, I brought
GQ is it's how do you feel about Mag in a Bag? I don't like Mag in a Bag.
Well,
not just because it's GQ.
I got this Mag in a Bag was in a bag because I got it in the goodie bag from GQ Men of the Year, which is a very, very fantastical event, and I haven't opened it yet. It sort of preempts the prize winners, so they're all the prize winners, starting with Tiny Temper on the front. And it is a very, very amazing event because it covers all sorts of... All human life is there. There will be, typically, there will be senior politicians, there will be literary novelists, there will be the descendants of Page Three Girls, who were slightly sleeker, and proper Hollywood A-listers, all in one place.
Big tent.
Big tent. It's very big tent or no-brow.
Where was it? In Berkeley Square?
It was in Covent Garden.
Oh, they moved it.
That structure, that additional bit.
Now, I'm not cueing you, Allegra, to have a go at it, but when you talk, I mean, you talked about sort of the likes of GQs versus rakes.
You heard the sigh there.
I know.
The audible sigh. I don't know.
Can we please release that magazine from the bag? It's driving me nuts. I hate magazines wrapped in plastic like that. Exactly.
It
needs to come with its own X-Acto knife.
And you also, of course, you have to have another supplement in there. There you go, GQ Trends. Do you need that?
I need that.
I thought you might.
Yeah. Hot Looks and Best Buys, brought to you by H&M.
No, this is instantly irritating, the flick through this, because it hasn't got that beauty that the rake has.
But it is brilliant.
I'm sure it is, because you seem to be sponsored by GQ today.
I really love it because of its universality.
It's got the same thing, and same underlying themes of, look, I mean, in the first three pages I've looked at, watches, clothes and cars. That's exactly what I saw in the rake.
That's exactly what you saw in the rake.
But a different level.
Exactly. And this has no interest to me, whereas the rake I can appreciate. Look, we're talking about a lesbian woman commenting on men's magazines. It's going to be, there needs to be something that draws me in here.
Then there's the rake is all about people who are completely obsessional, and that's appealing to anyone.
You?
No, to anyone. They like to see obsessional at the full.
No, because I think the rake is sort of unachievable, as you said earlier. It's not real. It's off the scale in terms of.
It is off the scale.
Whereas the thing about GQ is it's kind of on the scale in a rather boring way. Would you like to have a look?
I shine. It's almost. I mean, it's hyper laminated. Tiny Temper on the front.
Would you have known that was Tiny Temper?
Yes. And then there are things to buy.
Things to wear. What would be your equivalent of the rake when it comes to your world? The word world of all things culinary. I was going to say fashion.
Right. Yes.
Are you interested in fashion magazines? Not women's fashion magazines. I mean, you've got a lovely jumper on today. Where do you get your fashion cues? Or do you care to get them off the printed page or off a backlit screen?
No, I'm afraid I'm probably the least shopperish of the three people around this table. It's a kind of once every 6 months when I'm filming a new TV show, I go to Selfridges and spend a large amount of money. But there's no real joy in it for me. I like to go. I mean, everywhere I go, I get things to do with kitchens and food, and I can't help. I'm compulsive in that way. Yesterday I bought a whisk from the 1920s with a beautiful wooden handle that cost me 60 bloody quid. But I mean, it is a fantastic thing, and that's where I get my pleasure, my shopping pleasure.
And is there something on the printed page that reflects that when you look at magazines?
I've yet to see it. I mean, as I said, it's the real that I enjoy. The only one that I come back to is Fire and Knives. That's the only food publication that I actually regularly
read. But Allegra, nothing is real.
I like the way you lent into the microphone.
I was wondering whether your book, Bought, Bored and Stolen, was perhaps maybe foreshadowing a twice-a-year magazine, potentially.
Well, we should talk, Tyler.
We could, absolutely. You know, you've done a twirl in our kitchen before. Could be a nice little test kitchen for you.
I think I cooked. You were twirling.
That could very, very well be. I think it seems, I mean, not that we have to have a winner every week, but it seems like the rake did very well on today's program. And I don't think any of you are going to be sort of looking for perhaps even purchase of shares in Fairfax, it seems.
God, no.
God, at the end of that piece, I still didn't know what Fairfax was.
Allegra McEvity and Peter York, we're going to have to leave it there. Still on a Saturday morning here in London, that brings us to edition three of The Stack. We are going to be going over for a bit of news in about 25 seconds' time. Georgina Godwin is going to be here for the next hour. After that, it's going to be Emma Nelson and Gillian Dubias are going to be here with a review. That is at midday here. And then, of course, there's lots more music and other programs throughout. And, of course, the Monocle Weekly is here tomorrow. But it is goodbye for me and also my other crew here, Sam Impey behind the desk, Adrian Craddock, and, of course, our producer, Don Trump. News is coming up right now, 1 minute from now. Goodbye.